I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Goodbye, truckie.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other truckie.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
The In-Between is intended for mature audiences and may include topics that can be unsettling, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, rape, murder, and animal abuse. Testimony shared by guests of the show is their own and does not reflect the views of Mel Barrett, Ruby Grace Productions, or Grab Bag Collab. Listener discretion is advised.
Can we admit that we're all transfixed by that sick little soap opera trial in Exeter, New Hampshire?
What time did you get here today?
1:30 this morning.
1:30? Why?
Wanted to get a front row seat, I guess.
If this story were a made-for-TV movie, and it surely will be, you might not believe it.
It is August 1st, 1990. Time is 10 a.m. Seabrook, New Hampshire. We're about to do a one-party consent via telephone.
Sat around brainstorming the pros and cons of slitting a man's throat rather than firing a 38 caliber projectile through his head.
Yes.
There's only one person in the state of New York who is sitting in prison tonight with a sentence of life with absolutely no possibility of parole.
Yes, yes, I need a policeman. 4D Misty Morning Drive.
Okay, what's going on over there, ma'am?
There's somebody screaming for help outside.
Hello?
Hey, Paul, it's Mel Barrett. How are you?
Good, how you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
This is New Hampshire prosecutor turned defense lawyer Paul Maggiato. In 1991, he and co-counsel Diane Nicolosi prosecuted Pamela Smart for accomplice to first-degree murder, and in September of 2024, I finally got a chance to ask him some burning questions I've had for a very long time. I want to warn you that we sometimes speak over one another in this interview. I think it's still pretty easy to understand, but you've been warned. There's this phrase French folks like to use. I'll say it in English because my French sucks. The spirit of the stairway. Roughly translated, it means those brilliant things you think to say after a passionate conversation is over and you are no longer around the person you were speaking with. The things you wish you'd said, the thoughts you have as you're leaving the room, running down the stairs. I should have said that. Why didn't I ask that? For 3 days, I've been getting smacked in the head with my spirit of the stairway thoughts. The good news, dear listeners, is that I was able to record my conversation with Maggiato, so I can add my thoughts here, which I will do throughout this interview. I started off nervous. I finally had Paul Maggiato on the line and I could ask him anything. I made a rookie mistake by asking a giant question that could have been a 20-minute interview in and of itself. He picked up on my nerves and, well, he's called a bulldog for a good reason. During the Pam Smart trial, he reduced witnesses like Sonia Fortin to tears. I wasn't reduced to tears, but I definitely faltered a bit in the beginning before I gained my footing.
What do you think about this responsibility video that came out and the new petition for commutation?
I think it's just another attempt of Pam Smart to manipulate the facts in the situation.
Okay.
You want me to tell you why?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Pam Smart hasn't admitted anything. Pam Smart always does this little dichotomy where she tries to accept responsibility at the same time implying to everybody that she was wrongly convicted, that she's really not responsible for the murder, but nonetheless, here I am in jail, and therefore I should have your support to be pardoned. She's never once looked in the camera or said to her supporters, I admit that I got Billy Flynn to kill my husband. I admit that I drove them the night of the murder to pick up the getaway car. I admit I told them how to do the murder and to not to bother the neighbors. I admit I told them I was going to leave the bulkhead door open. I admit I tried to get Cecilia Pierce not to go to the police and talk to the police because I was afraid of being convicted. She's never once said that to anybody.
Yeah.
And the reason she's never said that to anybody is because then she would also have to admit for the last 30-odd years she's been lying to her supporters.
Hmm.
She's never admitted being part of the killing. She's always tried to imply that I'm responsible because I fell in love with this teenage boy and he went off and killed my husband. Therefore, I should have known better. Therefore, I was responsible for what he did. But that's not what the evidence was at trial. The evidence at trial was overwhelming. She orchestrated this murder. She was furious when Billy Flynn didn't complete the murder on two prior attempts. She chastised him and said, if you don't complete this murder, we're not going to be together. We heard testimony not only from Billy that that's what happened, and we heard testimony from Vance Ladd and me and Patrick Randell that they were all present in the car with Pam Smart when she was going over how the murder was going to take place. And we had testimony from Cecilia Pierce, how she had talked innumerable times about how Pam Smart wanted her husband killed. And we have the tapes. We have Pam Smart on tapes.
Maggiato speaks with such conviction that what he's saying is fact to him. I don't blame him. This is the story he had to tell in order to convince a jury that Pam Smart was guilty of accomplice to first-degree murder. What I should have asked him, had I been able to get a question in, was, does he think it's problematic that the teens involved were all housed together, sometimes in the same cells, and witnesses claim they were working on their stories together? Does he think that a witness who was high on cocaine and admitted to putting on a show of tears while testifying might be problematic? Does he feel there's any reason to question Bill, Pete, and JR's testimony, because they were told Pam would testify against them first if they didn't cop a plea? Does he feel uncomfortable about the fact that the teens and their moms destroyed evidence and were never charged?
The way it works in New Hampshire, in order to have a hearing, you have to have the executive committee and the governor okay giving her a hearing on a pardon request.
Right.
The governor and the executive committee voted no. We don't want to give you a hearing. Pam Smart thought that was a denial of her due process. And I think, I'm not sure whether Mark Sisti represented or not. I think it was Mark. They went to the Supreme Court and they asked the Supreme Court, was this a denial of due process? And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not a denial of due process. It's up to them whether or not they want to give you a hearing. So then she comes out with this video pleading to speak to the governor and pleading to speak to the executive council face to face and let her explain her remorse and let her explain her position. That's what she's trying to do. So basically what she's trying to do, give me a ad hoc hearing, which you're not willing to give me officially.
Mm.
And it's just manipulation. Do you think all of the people who have been giving money to Pam Smart's defense or supporting her over these years would still be as adamant as they are today if she looked them right in the face and said, okay, I admit it. I've been lying to you. I've been manipulating you. I did, in fact, plan this murder like the state charged. I did, in fact, get this kid to kill my husband. I did, in fact, tell him how to do it. I helped him get the getaway car. All the things I just said to you.
I'm not sure what supporters have been giving money to Pam Smart's defense. I know that a fundraiser on PayToIt was recently created because Pam Smart has a new legal team, and they need funds to support research, investigations, and the new legal arguments. But that fundraiser, as of this recording, has about $5,000 toward the $75,000 needed, and it looks like it goes directly to the lawyers who are working on her case. From what I understand, Pam is broke. She doesn't have enough money for even commissary. And if she were in a position to make money, say off a book or other venture, it would go to Greg Smart's family estate because they sued her in civil court and they won.
Do you think that it's a fair sentence? Is life in prison without, is that the right sentence for her?
Okay. Is that the right sentence for anybody who has been convicted of first degree murder? Because that's what the sentence is in New Hampshire.
She was convicted of accomplice to first degree. I actually have a question for you about that, but
sure. An accomplice to first degree murder is gets the same sentence as someone who commits first degree murder.
So is there a reason why you didn't charge first degree murder? You chose to what was the reasoning behind charging first?
You're making a mistake.
Okay.
By saying there's a difference between accomplice to first degree murder and first degree murder. Accomplice is someone who helps you commit the crime.
Right.
So if you and I plan a murder,
yeah,
and we go into a house and I hold the door open, I give you the gun, you go up to the person we're trying to kill and you shoot him and you and I run off, I'm guilty of that murder, but I didn't pull the trigger, so I'm called an accomplice.
Got it. Okay. And then in the state of New Hampshire, from what you're saying, there is no difference between accomplice to first degree for the mandated sentence, I should ask. There's no difference.
No difference.
I want to get into a little bit of the details, if you remember them. I know it's been a long time.
I remember them.
I'm sure you do.
I've had to review them recently and in the past several times for people who, every time she comes up trying to get some sort of consideration, and I'm requested to comment, I review the facts.
Okay.
And I'll tell you something, though.
Yeah.
The reason I am so willing to take these phone calls and make these conversations is I want the discussion to be on an accurate statement of facts.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, Pam Smart and other people have tried to change the narrative of what the facts were.
Okay.
And I don't want that to happen because Mr. Bill Smart's not around. Greg Smart's mother's not around.
Right.
There's not a lot of people around who can keep the facts straight. Let me ask you, have you also had a chance to read or hear the tapes?
I've only heard what was played in court. I haven't heard, there's what, five tapes? There were five tapes in all. Three were admitted into court and two were not, I believe.
I don't remember that. I remember there was two, there might have been a phone call and 2 days of actual recordings. I don't remember the ones that weren't admitted into court.
There were two.
What's your question about Raymond Fowler?
Paul does this a lot. He starts to answer but doesn't finish, moves on to something else. I noticed this happens when he isn't sure he remembers the facts. In this case, I needed to correct the record, so I went with that first, before getting into my questions about Raymond Fowler. Let me tell you, it's no fun trying to get the facts straight on one question while trying to circle back to what you were originally talking about, but I tried. Well, there were two tapes, just to go on the tapes for a second. Judge Gray wouldn't allow two of the tapes because they were just completely inaudible. The other two tapes were, you're right, the one that was a phone tap, and then the other two were body wire tap. So my question about Raymond is, I have a few questions about Raymond, actually. He always seemed wishy-washy about Pam's involvement, and he goes back and forth, and he goes back and forth on a lot of things, to be fair. He seemed all over the place with his story. But I was wondering why you didn't call him to testify like you did the other boys.
I think his case was still open, and he didn't have a deal with the state. So how could I call him? He has a right against self-incrimination.
Well, he was arrested. So Pam and Sisti and Paul had him on their witness list. And then he was charged pretty late. And because he was charged, he was going to plead the fifth. So they didn't call him. That's the way I understand it. But I'm just wondering, why was he charged so late, or why wasn't he called? So if you're saying he wasn't charged and that's why you didn't call him.
There's two things you have to understand.
Yeah.
Sisti and Toomey could have called him to the stand and asked the court to give him use immunity, meaning anything he says and his testimony could not be used against him.
Interesting.
So that doesn't preclude them from calling him to the stand.
Okay.
Okay. As I sit here today, I don't remember exactly when he was charged. You're telling me he was charged much later? But I think he was charged well before the trial, wasn't he?
He was charged before the trial, but at a certain point, he was on the defense's witness list, and he was planning to come in and testify. Then he got charged, and then his lawyers, advised him to plead the fifth. And at that point, Sisti and Toomey decided that it wasn't going to work for them if he's going to get up and plead the fifth, because they wouldn't be able to get anything out of him. That's the way I understand it from them. So that's why I'm asking you. I'm trying to understand what happened with Raymond and why he wasn't called.
Okay.
But, yeah.
I didn't call him because we called witnesses who we were able to question before they took the stand and could convince us that they were telling the truth.
Yeah.
And who also entered into a cooperation agreement. That agreement being, if they didn't tell the truth, then we would obviously not give them the reduced sentence we had talked about. We had no such agreement with Raymond Fowler.
Right.
Because Raymond Fowler hadn't agreed at that point in time to cooperate.
Mm.
So I can't call him to the stand.
Yeah.
If I know he's a not cooperating, and I knew he would take the fifth, whether he's charged or not, he could take the fifth.
So Raymond wouldn't cooperate with the prosecution. That's an overcomplicated way of saying he had a different story from Bill, Pete, and JR, and his testimony would have hurt the state's case. Further, Raymond's name comes up all over the trial as the fourth kid involved in the murder. I've always wondered why the jury wasn't asking, where is this kid?
Why isn't he here telling the same story these other kids are? No one questioned Raymond's absence from the trial, and I think that was another misstep by the defense. This jury in particular didn't get the full story, and in my opinion, the defense didn't do a good enough job explaining this story to them. In the trial transcripts, 10 days into the trial on March 14th, a lengthy meeting in chambers occurs with the judge and both sets of attorneys about the issue of Raymond Fowler's testimony or lack thereof. What sticks out to me in this meeting is that Raymond made many statements and that his statements were contradictory, to say the least. But more importantly, the defense claims a statement made by Dan Blake. If you recall from episode 4, Dan Blake was Raymond's cousin and later married Cecilia Pierce. In one of his police interviews, he tells detectives that, quote, Raymond did tell me he was supposed to get $1,000 from Pam for killing her husband, end quote. But the defense claims here that detectives changed Dan Blake's statement about Pam Smart paying for the murder after Dan Blake gave his statement, but before he signed it. Confused yet? Yeah, I was too. This entire motion hearing happening in Judge Gray's chambers is by the state to compel Raymond to testify to the handpicked statements the state says will help their case, while the defense argues that Raymond and Dan's statements were altered and contradict one another and the state shouldn't be allowed to cherry-pick them. If there are four teens involved in the murder, though there's speculation that there may have been more teens involved, we'll get into that in a later episode, and one of the teens' stories doesn't match the other three, should that be a bit of an alarm bell? The three teens, Bill, JR, and Pete, they were all housed together in juvie, and then in jail while awaiting the trial. Raymond was separated from them for some reason. They had plenty of opportunities to get their story straight. In fact, JR says in his letters that Bill and Pete kept getting into trouble at juvie because they were constantly talking to one another and they weren't supposed to be. By the time the teens go to jail, they're sharing cells, hanging out, watching the trial together. Two separate jailhouse snitches both signed affidavits testifying to the fact that they were all doing coke in jail. Bill specifically was doing lines because it made him more emotional on the stand, and he stated in one of his letters that he wasn't taking his boys down. Well, Raymond was another story, and they wanted to quote-unquote deal with Raymond.
When we were arrested, as you know, we were kids, which meant the state had to spend over 6 months to certify us. While Pam was an adult, she just got a trial date, which means she could go to trial long before us, leaving her the option that she was found guilty to testify against us for a lesser charge. You see, she had already told people that if she was found guilty, she would testify against us. Now with Raymond, we owe him. He already testified against us. We're going to return the favor.
Raymond was worried they'd try to kill him next. Is that why he was separated? Should the defense have hammered this point home? It gives me pause that one kid who isn't going along with the other three has a different story and is willing to testify for the defense might be telling the truth. Of course, the jury never heard about Raymond's path in all of this. Maggiato says he could have testified. This is something I'm going to keep digging at. I don't understand it yet, and I'm getting a lot of different answers. Maggiato claims above that the defense could have questioned Raymond under use immunity. Use immunity, according to the Legal Information Institute at Cornell, quote, protects the witness from the use of their own testimony against them, but does not prevent the government from using other evidence obtained from independent sources, end quote. So Maggiato claims the defense could have examined Raymond in front of the jury, but in chambers, Toomey argues, quote, straight under the Confrontation Clause of the New Hampshire Constitution, we object to the introduction of this because we wish to confront Mr. Raymond Fowler face to face, confront him with all of his inconsistencies, and let a jury see that process. See whether he says the same thing today, first of all. Let a jury, second of all, see that process, observe his demeanor, and watch him confronted. That's what confrontation is. Confrontation is not synonymous with impeachment through other sources. What the state wants to do is deny us confrontation, end quote. Maggiato claims the defense could have called Raymond to the stand, but the motion in chambers makes it sound like they don't think it's fair to have Raymond plead the fifth in front of the jury. Legal scholars, please make it make sense. At the end of the day, Raymond was never called, and during this meeting in chambers, Nicolosi, Maggiato's co-counsel, makes a suggestion that they tell the jury Raymond is quote-unquote unavailable. Just me, or is that sketch?
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You asked me at the start of this conversation what I thought about the trial. The evidence was overwhelming. As a prosecutor, and I've said this many times, it was our job not not to screw it up. This was not a close case. This was an overwhelming case. If you listen to the summation and where we outline all the evidence against Pam Smart, it wasn't close. Wasn't close. I mean, if we would have lost this case, I would have been stunned.
Did you ever struggle with, so you had the witness, you had Brian Washburn, Greg's best friend, saying that Pam came to him and said that she was going to try to entrap Cecilia. And then she went and entrapped Cecilia. So you feel like the tapes were sort of what sold this for you, I'm assuming.
I said the tapes were part of it. They weren't the only thing. Okay. I mean, if you listen to personally, what I said in my summation was, if you believed Bill Flynn, that's all you needed. You didn't need any more evidence because Bill Flynn could convince you beyond a reasonable doubt that Pam Smart had got him to commit this murder. But the beauty of the case and the beauty of the jury was you didn't have to rely on just Bill Flynn. You could rely on Patrick Randall, who corroborated his story, and Raymond and Van Flatamy. Those three people corroborated their stories. And then you have Cecilia Pierce. Cecilia Pierce was not a buddy of Bill Flynn and Van Flatamy and Patrick Randall. She didn't run in that crowd.
Hold on. This is factually inaccurate. I wasn't feeling comfortable enough to interrupt like I do at the end of this interview, but here I have to say no. Bill, Cecilia, and Pam were constantly hanging out together. They went to the club together. They drove around drinking wine coolers together. JR references Cecilia in his testimony about her helping them find a gun. The kids, including Cecilia and a friend named Sarah, were all hanging out at JR's house when Sarah says she found a love letter to Bill from Pam in the pocket of Bill's coat. Cecilia later married Dan Blake, Raymond's cousin and a friend of the group. And here I go again, doing something I said I wouldn't do. I said I wouldn't talk about Cecilia's alleged crush on Bill. Well, up until a few weeks ago, I didn't have anything concrete, but I've now seen the police interviews, and more than one person brought up the fact that Cecilia definitely had a crush on Bill and was jealous of Pam. The point is, Cecilia Pierce most certainly ran in that crowd, and she may have had a motive to help murder Greg.
So you don't buy the argument that she was saying those things to try to trap Cecilia?
No, it's comical. You listen to what, if you read the transcripts,
that's my next question.
Not what she said. She didn't say she was trying to entrap Cecilia Pierce. In her testimony at trial, Pam Bond said, I was trying to gain information. Yeah. So I wanted to pretend I knew more about the case than I really did to see what Cecilia Pierce would say.
So who actually transcribed the tapes?
I believe it was the secretary in the attorney general's office.
Again, this deserves a follow-up. If you haven't listened to episode 5, The Tapes Lie, I go on a deep dive about the wiretaps used to convict Pamela Smart. But I'll reiterate here, the quote-unquote secretary was not a certified transcriber. How could she, when everyone else was having a really hard time hearing what was on the tapes, even an audio engineer who contracted with the FBI, transcribe these tapes? How in the hell could she even decipher who was speaking and when, enough to attribute a name to the dialogue? I hate that any weight whatsoever was placed on the transcripts. They were not evidence. They should never have been used against Pam Smart. And the tapes should never have been admitted as evidence. Judge Gray even misspoke and called the transcripts evidence before he corrected himself, and then he told the jury they weren't evidence and that they should only be used as a guide. He instructed that where the jury found the transcripts to be inconsistent with the audio on the wiretaps, they should disregard the transcripts and only go with what they hear on the wiretaps. You've heard bits and pieces of the wiretaps. Could you decipher what was being said? Now imagine if you were on the jury and had the transcripts to guide you through the almost inaudible wiretaps. Would you be able to unring that bell after seeing the words on the page? After months of the media telling you this woman was guilty of planning her husband's murder? I dare you to try. I spoke with Carolyn Koch of Jury Solutions, who is a jury consultant with decades of experience advising lawyers on jury selection and the juror's mindset. Here's what she had to say about confirmation bias and juries who might be filling in the blanks.
Well, you know, there's multiple layers of problems in the criminal justice system and the media. And the fact that judges have so much power over the process to make it fair or not fair. And there really isn't a cure for that, because lawyers are advocates and they can try and get the judge to do things differently. But a lot of times the lawyers don't have sufficient experience in these kinds of cases to know what are the things that we need to do to prevent jurors from sitting on a case who've already concluded that the defendant's guilty. And so much of that depends on a really effective voir dire process, that in some of these high profile cases, the exact opposite happens. In any kind of high profile media situation, you know, jurors, there has to be special safeguards taken. And a lot of judges and lawyers don't do that. You know, even just having people write down their opinions, or even just, you know, in some of the cases that I've worked on that had a lot of media exposure, you know, it's not just saying, have you read about it? Can you set it aside? It's how many articles have you read? You know, what are the sources that you have read? What conclusions have you came to from what you read? Mm-hmm. And then only when you get that, you know, whether or not someone can set it aside, if they draw a conclusion and how they write it out in their own words, it could be pretty clear that that person's not going to be able to set it aside.
Right.
You know, versus a person says, you know, I just heard something about it and I turned it off because I wasn't interested and I haven't really drawn any conclusions. You know, you're just trying to figure out. But if you have no vetting at all,
yeah,
you know, and this people in all kinds of cases, you know, like from petty to big, there's all kinds of ways the fairness can go off the rails.
I will also tell you this, Mel, just to eliminate any question on your part. The transcripts were given to the defense counsel.
That was my next question.
And they had plenty of opportunity to listen to the tapes with the transcripts, and they never raised an objection of the transcripts being used, claiming they were inaccurate.
Okay.
They had the opportunity to come and listen to the actual tapes in the Attorney General's office so they can compare them to the transcripts.
Okay. And then I had a couple more questions just about Cecilia Pierce specifically. First of all, why didn't Cecilia have a plea agreement if everybody else did?
I guess we didn't really believe that she was buying into having Greg Smart killed.
Wow. Finally, I have an answer to this question, though it does still feel like she had a verbal plea agreement all the way up until the day she testified, when Paul and Diane told her at lunch that she wouldn't be arrested for the crime she'd committed. Still, just to be certain, why not get it on paper, Paul, like you did with the boys? It doesn't make sense.
This is one of those things that came out of the internet, but he also had a lot of details when he was telling me about this, so it's something I'm trying to track down. He was saying that there were latent prints taken off the locking mechanism of the bulkhead, and that Cecilia Pierce's prints were included. A 6-point identifier was found of Cecilia Pierce's prints on the bulkhead. Do you know anything about that?
Never heard of that before.
Yeah, Sisti said the same thing. I just don't know where. He said he saw it in a police report. He seemed so detailed about it, so I've really been trying to figure it out. Do you know if they pulled prints from the bulkhead at all?
The kids work well.
You still check, right? All right, back to my interview.
If you're asking me, did they dust the bulkhead for prints and then, come up with nothing? I don't know, but you got to remember, we didn't know anything about the bulkhead being left open until
right.
The boys were arrested 6 weeks later.
A thorough investigation should have included the entire crime scene, interior and exterior. Every entry and exit should have been fingerprinted.
So, you know, they weren't thinking the bulkhead was left open for these burglars to get in. Let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
There's no question that Cecilia Pierce had spent quite a bit of time at Pam Smart's house.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Bill did too, absolutely.
Right. So even if we found their prints, what evidentiary value would it have?
Well,
even if we found Bill Flynn's prints on there.
I have a question specifically. This is something that I've been rolling around in my brain a little bit. If Cecilia Pierce's prints are on the locking mechanism of the bulkhead door, then there is a question about who opened the bulkhead.
Okay. But the question is, who opened the bulkhead when?
Right. But I guess, you know, I mean, coming from New England, no one I know that came to our house would ever come into the house through the bulkhead.
But But you don't know if Pam Smart would have said this to Susan Pierce, hey, would you open the bulkhead door and let the dog out, or open the bulkhead door, bring some garbage in, or open the bulkhead door. I mean, I don't know.
But that's the point. We don't know. How is it not plausible that Cecilia Pierce could have let the boys in without Pam's knowledge? What if that is the only thing that could prove that she, in fact, didn't have a role in the planning of the murder? One life has already been lost, Greg's, and another, Pam Smart's, is on the line. Don't you think it's worth finding out instead of putting blinders on and careering in the direction of one subject?
Let me just say this to you.
Yeah.
Here you have Mark Sisti, who's a pretty thorough and pretty good defense lawyer, myself, and we're both telling you that neither one of us have any recollection of the bulkhead being tested and or finding prints there. So the only way to validify it is to go to the police reports and see. But even if there were, there's no, I can't imagine any way in hell you can come up with a scenario that that somehow raises a question as to her guilt. I guess one of the reason I'm interrupting you, I think sometimes the media does a disservice when they try and raise questions and try and make a mountain what I'd suggest is at best a molehill. And unless there's a real supportable fact that her fingerprints were on this bulkhead, go ahead and do what you gotta do.
You're also giving me a prosecutor's answer, though, because my job is to figure out if there are any holes and if I can tell that story too. You know what I mean? I understand that you don't want me to ask questions that are unfounded in fact, but I still have to ask the questions if they pop up and it seems like information that should be in the file.
Don't misunderstand me. Oh. I'm not saying you can't ask questions. I don't want you to ask questions implying there's a factual basis to support them.
Got it.
That's all I'm saying.
Got it.
Because that's what happens all the time now, and you see it in our general elections, you know, about eating cats and eating dogs.
God, don't get me started. I know.
To make that allegation. So, but you go ahead and do it. You can ask anything you want. I mean, and it's also, I'll just leave it at that.
I'm going to go ahead and let this comment stand on its own for now. I have a lot to say about it, but I think it's important for you to make up your own mind about Maggiato's tactics here. And like Maggiato says, I'll just leave it at that.
I am also thinking of the sentence. The sentence is something that I have a hard time with.
Let me address the sentence.
Yeah, please.
Okay. We all can sit here and say life without parole is too extreme in a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But let's take this in context. My understanding and recollection is life without parole was a compromise when most states got away with the death penalty.
Right.
So in lieu of having the death penalty for first-degree murder cases, they said, okay, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll incarcerate people for life.
Right.
So let's say we want to say life without parole is too extreme. And if the legislature wants to come up with a process to review those types of cases, all the power to them. Mm-hmm. I myself have represented an inmate who was sentenced to life without parole for killing his girlfriend and tried to get him a pardon. So if we're going to have a process by which we want to review these sentences, let's do it. But then in that scenario, where does Pam Smart fall in the list of people who are qualified,
right,
let's say, to get a consideration? And my response is, she's never once admitted her responsibility in the crime.
And I would say that the opposite of that, though, is I think a lot of people believe that somebody who spends that long in prison and refuses to admit their guilt might be innocent. I think that could be an argument as well. But then going back to the sentencing, you know, I've been talking to Ashley Nellis at the Sentencing Project, and I think that they are, you know, they're considering age as a factor. And I think that's the one thing that I'm looking at, too. She was 22. You know, they're looking at, they just changed the laws in Massachusetts, 21 and under, or I guess under 21, can't get life without parole. And Ashley Nellis is saying, you know, the cognitive, behavioral issues with a 22-year-old person's brain, you know, we don't fully develop until we're 25.
I know where you're going with that. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay.
Let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Why doesn't Cam Smart come forward and say, I was complicit in planning the murder of my husband, but I was a young undeveloped, immature person who really didn't know the impact of what I was doing. But she's not saying that.
Well, because I'm going to be honest with you, Paul, I don't think she believes. I think she believes she's innocent.
I think she's convinced herself so she could convince her supporters. So you acknowledge that this whole business then of accepting responsibility is BS. She's not accepting responsibility. She's accepting responsibility for an affair. That's it.
She is accepting, that's the differentiation. I think she accepts responsibility for the affair. She accepts responsibility for the fact that her relationship led to her husband's death, but she refuses to take any responsibility for the planning of the murder. And okay, as adamant as she is, I have to give it some credit.
That was her testimony at trial. Her testimony at trial was that, yes, I had the affair. I didn't tell anybody because I couldn't believe he killed my husband. She went to the press after her husband's death and said we had a great marriage, that we were madly in love, never once suggesting to the police, oh my God, I know who might have killed my husband, this crazy boy who I was having an affair with. She never said any of those things. And she said to Cecilia Pierce, and it's on one of the tapes, if I ever get arrested, I will admit the affair, but me, with my education and my professional position, who are they going to believe, me or the boys?
Still, the point I see here is that someone who refused a plea deal in 1990 claimed she was not guilty of planning the murder of her husband and has stuck by that for 34 years when she's being told at every turn to take responsibility for something she says she didn't do, even though it could help her see the light of day again. Might be telling the truth? Maybe?
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
It's a continued manipulation to get around the hearing requirement. And I think until she admits what she did and accepts responsibility and is honest with the courts, honest with the governor, the executive council, and her supporters, I don't think she's entitled or qualified for a pardon.
Last couple of questions. Is there anything you would have done differently? A.
Not that I can think of. I mean, the reality is when you win the case, you don't second guess how you did it.
Right.
So some people said, I didn't even have to cross-examine Pam Smart. I could just rely on her statements and ask her if that was her voice on the tape and stop there. But other people said the cross-examination was wonderful. So I don't really second guess anything. I didn't spend any time doing that.
This is a tough answer for me to swallow. I want to understand why you wouldn't question your actions when it comes to the death of one human being and the life without parole sentence of the victim's wife. Shouldn't we want to make sure we did everything in our power to get it right? This is the one I've been sitting with a lot. It keeps me up at night. At the suggestion of my editor, Amber Hunt, I reached out to an expert in the field of conviction integrity. This is a similar body that overturned Maggiato's murder conviction in Brooklyn, which I covered in previous episodes and will discuss later in this episode. I spoke with Marissa Bluestein from UPenn Law about why conviction integrity units are important and why prosecutors should want to make sure they got it right. Here's what she had to say.
Almost every prosecutor I've ever talked to will say, look, you know, we all have that one case. You know, the one case that we're like, I don't know, maybe that wasn't the right outcome. And I would expect most prosecutors, if not, you know, the vast majority of prosecutors have that kind of maybe about at least one case or two cases that they've had. So I think I doubt that the vast majority of prosecutors have an absolute shut the door mentality about cases that they've worked on. And at least in speaking with us, you know, again, whether it's a line DA or an appellate DA, they'll all say, yeah, of course we make mistakes. Of course that there've been cases that we've handled where somebody may have been convicted of a crime they didn't commit. They recognize the possibility. Right. But of course, personalizing is a little harder. To say, yeah, that happened to me because, you know, I'm an ethical prosecutor. I wouldn't prosecute somebody that I thought was guilty. Of course they would, right? Nobody would prosecute somebody they thought was innocent. That doesn't happen. But, you know, it's the issue that is that we're all human beings. We all have cognitive biases. We all look at things through certain lenses. And if you're looking at evidence through the lens of this is the person who committed this murder, then, you know, everything gets kind of fit into that confirmatory bias stance as opposed to the other, right? Like for prosecutors and law enforcement who are looking at evidence through the lens of this individual committed the crime, they're not trying to get it wrong. They just don't see the exculpatory value of the evidence because they're looking at it through a confirmatory lens, not trying to test a hypothesis that they already have because we're human, right? We all do it. And then once, you know, that's just how we go through the world. You know, right. It would be like freaking chaos in our brains otherwise.
Yeah.
So because they're human, you know, they all have this opinion. I've never prosecuted an innocent person because they don't believe, because that's truly what they believe. Right. So it's a very big turnaround in the brain to kind of get to the point of accepting that somebody that I've convicted was in fact innocent of that.
We have to make sure we get this right, especially when it comes to life in prison, life without parole, and the death penalty. When a 22-year-old is convicted of accomplice to first-degree murder, we have to get it right. And we have to be open to questioning whether we got it right. I'm not going to lie to you and say I'm not disappointed in Maggiato's answer to this question, because I am. I want to believe as prosecutors and human beings, we are able to question our decisions and our choices. Maggiato earlier made the analogy that Pam Smart supporters are somehow indoctrinated into her manipulation, the way some political sycophants have been drinking the Kool-Aid on one side of our current political spectrum. It felt like a manipulation tactic to me, to be honest with you. It felt like Maggiato was trying to paint a whole group of people with a brush of ignorance so they wouldn't question this case. I could say the same about not questioning if you would have done things differently in a murder trial. Confirmation bias can exist in both worlds.
If I lost the case, I would have spent a lot of time second guessing it. But
Do you think she got a fair trial?
Absolutely. Why didn't she?
Well, I mean, people bring up the media. People bring up some of the judges' decisions.
Let's talk about the media.
Brady,
right?
All that stuff.
I'm not sure if Paul heard me here when I said, quote unquote, Brady and all that stuff, mentioning the alleged Brady violations in the trial. But he skirts past this point. Take that as you will.
Why was the press so fascinated with this case? Part of the reason the press was so fascinated with this case is that Pam Smart is giving interviews on WMUR shortly after the murder, calling up
Bill Spencer.
Thank you, Bill Spencer, and asking him to come to the house so she could tout. There was some speculation. Was this a drug deal that went bad? And she was going on the press saying what a wonderful marriage they had. Her husband wasn't a drug dealer. She was setting the scene with Bill Spencer. How do you want me to sit? How is my makeup right? You know, I'm paraphrasing, but
yeah.
It was very, she was looking for attention. She wanted the attention. And when she got all the attention, it just drove the press nuts that she is asking for all this attention and she was the one who orchestrated the murder. I think it's like the righteous fall, a lot more publicity.
This is an argument that a lot of prosecutors, and I'll go a step further and say men, make when a woman is the center of the investigation. She wanted the media attention. It's a tired trope, in my opinion, but more on that in a few minutes.
I'm still struggling. I know that you're saying that accomplice to first and first degree are the same, but I feel like the statutes that I read, they differentiate between the two and they just don't put a sentencing mandate for accomplice.
When I get off the phone, I will look up the statute and give you the site.
You're amazing. But, thank you.
If I don't do that within a day or two, send me a text reminding me that I said I would do it.
Okay.
For the record, Maggiato made good on his promises and sent me the statutes early the next morning, though I was confused when he sent me RSA 636, which in the state of New Hampshire is robbery. So I let him know that I thought he meant 626 and he agreed. He sent me 631-A3, quote, a person convicted of a capital murder shall be sentenced to imprisonment for life without the possibility of parole, end quote. And RSA 626-83, which states, quote, a person is an accomplice of another person in the commission of an offense if A, with the purpose of promoting or facilitating the commission of the offense, he solicits such other person in committing it, or aids or agrees or attempts to aid such other person in planning or committing it, or B, his conduct is expressly declared by law to establish this complicity, end quote. Let's take a quick minute to break this down. I understand what the statutes say, but it still doesn't make sense that if in New Hampshire, a person who was involved in the planning of first-degree murder could also be charged with first-degree murder, then why didn't the DA's office charge Pam with first-degree murder if they thought she was complicit in the planning of the murder? They instead charged her with accomplice to first-degree murder. My assumption is that they didn't feel a jury would convict her of first-degree murder. I'll get into this in later episodes, but Judge Gray made a point to remind the jury that Pam was not being charged with first-degree murder, though the crime that Bill and Pete committed was first-degree. Have I said first-degree and murder enough in this paragraph? In the state of New Hampshire, the sentence for first-degree murder is a mandatory life without parole sentence. But what's the mandatory for accomplice to first-degree? Maggiato says it's the same as first-degree, but I've not found that in any of the statutes I've researched or the ones he gave me. It's an open question that I'm still digging into.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Pam Smart was offered the opportunity to be willing to plead guilty, but the message I recall her sending to us was, no way, I'm not going to.
And you don't question that at all? You don't question that?
Why would I question it?
Well, it's interesting to me.
I don't mean to be... That doesn't make me believe somebody's innocent. It makes me believe that someone thinks they can beat the case. And she thinks, like what she said to Cecilia Pierce, that she couldn't believe that people would believe the boys over her. And she also probably didn't want to believe the insurmountable evidence that we had against her. And she took the stand trying to refute it all. Most defendants would never do that. And she just thought she was capable and smarter than everybody and pull this off. And she was wrong. So, you know, if I have a question about the evidence and a defendant is adamant about going to trial, it might make me think twice.
Again, women manipulate. I'll get to this in a moment.
But I repeat myself. The evidence was overwhelming in this case.
I get it. I had to push a little bit, though.
You can push all you want. You know, I've been doing this for 30-some-odd years.
I know.
I mean, this is nothing, but... So
I know.
I don't push all you want. I mean, I'm not offended, but I just want to make sure everybody's got the right facts. And the last thing I'll say about life without parole,
yeah.
Pam is 50-something, I'm guessing. I don't really know how old she is.
Yeah.
She was 22 when it happened. It's 30 years ago. She's in her mid-50s.
Yeah.
You could bet dollars to donuts Greg Smart would like to have the next 20 years of his life left if he was 50-something years old.
Absolutely. Yep.
And if Bill Smart was alive, and I can't remember his mother's first name, but if she was alive, they'd be screaming bloody murder with the idea that Pam could get out now.
Right. I know.
Don't
I mean, Greg is the victim in all of this, and he did not deserve to have his life taken. That's for sure.
That's for damn sure.
Right? Yeah. All right.
And look at the boys. I mean, the boys were 16 years old when this happened.
16, 17, 16. 18, yeah.
Can you imagine being 16 and spending 25 years in prison and not getting out till you're 40-something?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. They were all kids.
Anyways.
I appreciate you, Paul.
Have fun.
If I have any follow-ups, do you mind if I text?
Not at all.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks.
All right, bye.
Bye. Oh, God.
As I mentioned a few minutes ago, I want to address something I see too often when a woman has been charged with and or convicted of murder. I've brought this up before, but let's dig deeper here. We've heard it said in so many cases of women accused of violent crimes.
She was pulling strings. You know, she had a hold and she was trying to manipulate him into believing that all these things were happening when they weren't.
It seemed that Chelsea always chose people she could manipulate. She liked to be in control and she chose people who she could control. One person called her a master manipulator.
What I'm going to be doing is showing you advanced female manipulation strategies that women will consistently use to get the power over high-value men.
She is not a warm person in this interview. I don't care who you are, she's intense. And intense is okay. Some people are intense, others aren't. But I see no grief, no sorrow, no sadness when she's talking about, because he's dead. The only thing I see is aggravation at why they're questioning her.
This woman is a sociopath.
Katie is very calculating. You can just tell that in speaking with her.
This was a common theme in Maggiato's reasoning. Pam is and always has been a manipulator. She manipulated Bill. She manipulated Bill Spencer from WMUR. She tried to manipulate the police. Others have said she was shipped out of New Hampshire to New York because she was manipulating the whole prison. She manipulated her family, friends, and to this day continues to manipulate her supporters or anybody who questions her sentence. After 34 years and refusing to say she's guilty for a crime she says she didn't commit, the planning of the murder of her husband. If you want to go down a rabbit hole of misogyny, go check out some of the influencers in the quote-unquote manosphere. Try to not throw up in your mouth while you're watching, but, you know, stay informed, I guess. The manosphere influencers love to categorize women as manipulative and give pointers on how to avoid manipulation strategies women try to use on quote-unquote high-value men, whatever the fuck that is. I don't think Maggiato's a bad guy. Don't get me wrong. I really appreciated his time. He eventually left the prosecutor's office to become a defense attorney, which in my opinion means he cares about folks and fighting for their rights and freedoms. He is no longer a practicing attorney, which is why I couldn't find his number initially, but he spent his life mostly trying to do the right thing, and I commend him for that. I'll remind you, we are not our worst mistakes. You, me, Pam Smart, or Maggiato. In the back of my mind, I'm also reminded that he misled a jury in Brooklyn in the late 80s at the height of the AIDS crisis about a witness he assumed had AIDS and was suicidal, which led to a 4-month stay in a psychiatric unit for the witness, not Maggiato. The jury convicted the accused, Gerard DeMond, and sentenced him to 25 years in prison. Again, this stinks. I cover in depth what the Conviction Integrity Unit uncovered in episode 5, so check that out. Maggiato gave up his time freely to me. We spoke for nearly an hour, and even when I was trying to end the interview, he wanted to keep going. But there is something floating beneath the surface that is eating at me. His adamance that he and the AG's office did nothing wrong here, that the case was solid. I see it differently and tried to push, but he wasn't hearing it. The best example is the question about Cecilia Pierce's possible fingerprints on the bulkhead. His answer, quote, the kids wore gloves, end quote, as if this was a fact I didn't already know and would prove that he and the investigators had it right. When I bring up why it's not good enough, he still blames Pam Smart. Maggiato says, quote, you don't know if Pam Smart would have said this to Cecilia Pierce. Hey, would you open the bulkhead door and let the dog out, end quote. He's right, I don't know this, but neither does he. Because as far as he's concerned, no one fingerprinted the bulkhead locking mechanism, which technically is the interior of the condo. When I pushed, he tells me no one knew Bill and Pete had entered through the bulkhead until 6 months later. This is not a good enough answer, but Maggiato thinks it should be, and I don't. Listen, I'm not an expert at asking prosecutors hard questions yet. This is my first investigative podcast, so I know there's room to grow and learn, but even I understand when I'm being gaslighted. Here's what I hope you'll take from this. We got some answers, but we didn't get factual answers per se. We got an ex-prosecutor's opinion that his side was right, and there's no room to question the investigation, the evidence, the trial, the verdict, or the sentencing because a jury said she was guilty. It slammed shut. The evidence was overwhelming. Does that mean I shouldn't question the investigation, the prosecution, the judge, the jury, the evidence, or lack thereof? Abso-friggin-lutely not. At the end of the day, I'm going to keep digging. The answers to the questions I did get to ask Maggiato don't cut the mustard for me. So I followed up. Paul and I couldn't make a time to work to get on the phone this time, so we texted back and forth. Honestly, I wish we'd done that the whole time. We don't step over one another in text. We had a thoughtful, detailed conversation about the facts. I'm sure you're super sick of my voice at this point, so I'll play you a reenactment of our conversation.
I had some follow-up questions from our interview, if you have a moment. I've had a chance to listen to the wiretaps and read the transcripts. I'm still trying to figure out the person who transcribed the tapes. Do you know their name?
You are overlooking that the tapes and transcripts were provided to defense before trial. They never claimed they did not accurately reflect what was said.
I'm not overlooking this fact. I think they should have pushed harder on the tapes. I've enhanced the audio and found a lot of inconsistencies between the transcripts and the tapes. I know Gray instructed the jury to only use the transcripts as a guide, but I'm wondering about confirmation bias here. I've heard the tapes. I'm really struggling to understand how a secretary in the AG's office, who wasn't a certified transcriber, was able to transcribe these tapes. Was it one person who transcribed or different people? Did she have help? Was she influenced in any way? Who tasked her with transcribing the tapes?
I am not familiar with a certification, a certificate for transcribing.
Transcripts are certified by professional transcribers. This happened less in the 90s, but it's standard practice for cases nowadays.
I have no recollection who transcribed the tapes. I do recall vaguely it was a secretary. Influenced in what way? You're really reaching for some sort of conspiracy theory, aren't you? Again, the safeguard is that the transcripts and the tapes were provided in advance to the defense. They had every opportunity to claim that the transcripts were inaccurate. Pam Smart had every opportunity to claim that what was on the tapes or the transcripts was not what she said. That wasn't her testimony at trial. Can you explain her testimony?
Not searching for a conspiracy. I'm trying to get to the bottom of the questions I have and appreciate you taking the time to answer them.
I'm not sure it is who you used to enhance the transcripts. We used an expert used by the FBI. You assert you found inconsistencies. Are they material or inconsequential? I'd be interested to hear why you think those inconsistencies help. I get it, you have a podcast to create, but this is all old news.
I enhanced the tapes myself, bringing up EQ and dropping out low frequencies, as well as getting rid of some of the hum and background noise. The FBI wouldn't have had the ability to do that back then on cassette tapes. They did the best they could. Some of the inconsistencies do appear to be material. In one of the instances, you used the transcript to show the jury a conversation on the whiteboards that was definitely off from what's on the tapes. I have about 8 handwritten pages of notes that detail some of the misses and inconsistencies on the 713 tape alone.
And now we wait.
And now we wait.
On second thought, you might check the cover of the transcripts. Usually, who transcribes a deposition or things of that nature's name is right on it. Secondly, by a certified transcript, you might be thinking about a stenographer for a court who will certify that the transcript is accurate. So that might have skipped my mind when I was dictating yesterday. My guess is the Attorney General's office was either too cheap to pay their cost, or whoever our transcriber was qualified enough. I simply don't remember.
There's no name on the transcript. I've spoken with a transcription company that's been working with law enforcement for about 15 years, and most DAs these days require a transcript to be certified if the transcript is a guide for surveillance evidence.
Fair enough. All I can say is that a secretary probably did in the first instance with prosecution and then the defense, then listened to the tapes with the transcript to ensure accuracy.
You mentioned in our interview that you didn't think investigators fingerprinted the bulkhead. Do you think it's an issue that investigators didn't fingerprint an entry exit at the crime scene? Cecilia Pierce mentions in the tapes that her fingerprints are on that thing. Do you know what she's referencing here? Thanks so much for any comments you can give me. I truly appreciate your time.
Concerning the bulkhead not being tested for fingerprints, nobody knew the bulkhead was the means of entrance until Cecilia Pierce cooperated with the police. Perhaps they should have tested their fingerprints. Candidly, as I sit here, I have no recollection whether they did or didn't. But how does it matter? In any event, all the boys testified that's how they were let in. What would fingerprints show? Are you suggesting there was somebody else who was in the house that hasn't been accounted for as I sit here? I don't know what Cecilia Pierce was referring to when she says her fingerprints are on that thing.
I'm not suggesting anything, just trying to track down this lead about Cecilia's fingerprints on the bulkhead. Though as for someone else being in the house, some of the police reports state that Raymond told friends he was in-house, and another report states Raymond told a friend that Dan Blake was also in the car. I really appreciate your help. I know this was a long time ago, but I'm just trying to be accurate. Thanks again, Paul.
There are still questions about Cecilia Pierce, Raymond Fowler's role in his story. There are questions about who knew what and when, about who actually shot Greg Smart, about the fingerprints, and, of course, if Pamela Smart had anything to do with the planning of the murder, a fact she's denied for 34 years, starting with not taking a plea deal from the state of New Hampshire in 1990. On the next episode of The In-Between, we'll get back to the chronological story. So thanks for listening to this detour. I thought it was important, and I'd love to know what you think. Next time on The In-Between.
Jury reached a verdict on each of the three offenses charged.
Yes, we have.
On case number 90-1371, which charges the defendant with the crime of accomplice to first degree murder. How to say, is the defendant guilty or not guilty of the offense charged?
Fatal marriages when marriage turns to murder.
I think that judges in the state today would have entertained venue changes and sequestration of the jury. Mm-hmm.
And when she was in jail awaiting trial, she had a friend there whose husband agreed to kill one of the girls who was testifying against her.
I'm not sure about you, but I know for sure defense attorneys aren't supposed to claim their clients are guilty.
She honestly was involved, right up to her neck.
Mr. Barrett. As far as I know, Mr. Kane has not been in forensic practice for many years. Our last contact was more than a decade ago. I have no knowledge of the case you mentioned, nor of his report in that matter.
Q2, side A, 74 seconds. Suspicious breaks during ongoing conversation.
Paul Toomey. He told the jury Pam Smart was guilty, and it worked. The jury didn't even deliberate when they voted unanimously on day one that Pam Smart was guilty of witness tampering. The In-Between is written, edited, and hosted by me, Mel Barrett. I also do some of the audio editing, but I couldn't content edit this sucker without the amazing Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Amber Hunt, my editor. Amber keeps me on track and helps cut the bullshit. Thanks, Amber. Thanks as well to my research partner and cousin-in-law, Lacey Umbel. I also couldn't get this done without the kick-ass team at Grab Bag Collab, Amber Hunt, Amanda Rossman, and Daisy Egan. The In-Between wouldn't exist without the encouragement and support of my dear friend, fellow podcaster, and all-around rock star, Yellen Marie Marsh. I love you, Ellen. Thanks for all you do. And I want to send another shout-out to Rebecca Lavoie over at Crime Writers On, who gave me my first feedback on the series and encouraged me to pitch it. Thanks, Rebecca. Finally, my love, my partner, Lindsay. Your support and belief in me always keeps me moving forward, even when the way ahead is very dark. Thanks for doing this with me. Also, your reenactments are my favorite. If you want to dive deeper into the cases I cover, visit inbetweenpod.com for source material and updates. You can find all the episodes and bonus content of The In-Between on the Grab Bag Collab main Patreon feed. Until the next time, be good people and don't do murder.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.